I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to episode 99 of the Bulak Podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay in Amman, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Marsha Links Quayle in Rabat. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about the Egyptian writer Hamdi Abu Ghulayl, who passed away unexpectedly on June 11th. This was a shock to all of us and a great loss. We have done a previous episode on a wonderful novel of Abu Ghulayl's called The Men Who Swallowed the Sun, and we'll be rerunning that episode as part of this one. But before we get there, we want to spend some more time talking about his other work and his life, his really unique talent and unique trajectory. We wanted to share a bit more about this writer who we both knew and we both appreciated very much.
Yeah, and I'd like to start just with a little thumbnail sketch of Hamdi's biography for people who don't know him. Hamdi was born in 1968, and he didn't go to university, and instead he worked, including as a journalist, and published his first short story collection in 1997, and his first novel, Thieves in Retirement, in 2002. And Mohamed Khair, in a reflection on him in Recife 22, called him Hamdi the nihilist, Hamdi the sarcastic, Hamdi the theoretician of impotence, the advocate of surrender. And I think we'll expand on those things a little bit. He was also a sort of a slow writer, a considered writer. He published four novels and three short story collections, along with a memoir, a book for children. His most recent novel, published novel, was My Stone Hands, which took him 10 years to complete. And at the time of his death, he was writing a novel that he was calling Dik Ummi, which he talked about in a number of interviews, including one with Ibrahim Fawzi for Arab Lit. And apparently, I read elsewhere that Darashuruk was nervous about the title, but he insisted on it. And I know that he loved a well-crafted title.
How would you translate that?
My mother's cock, I guess, is my preferred
We should let people know what it means, yeah.
My mother's rooster is how we translated it on Arab Lit, but I think maybe my mother's cock is a better translation. And he was planning for this novel to be about his mother. He was part of the 90s generation, and he wrote novels that sort of center his own experience, and that was an important part of his literary project. And among the writers whose work inspired him and he built on are Egyptian writers Ibrahim Aslan, Mohamed Mustagib, and Khairi Chalabi, and also Moroccan writer Mohamed Choukri and Palestinian Emil Habibi.
I think just the other thing that's important to mention about him is that he came from a Bedouin community in southern Fayoum, and the stories of his tribe, his village, his family feature prominently in his writing. It was within living memory of that community that they had been more or less forcibly settled, but their Bedouin identity was still quite strong. And so he came to Cairo as a young man, really you know, on his own to actually work like menial jobs and try to pursue a career as a writer. So he was really an outsider in a lot of ways to Cairo, to literary circles, to, you know, the sort of middle class intelligentsia. And that's part of, I think, what made him and his writing and the stories he told quite unique.
Right. But I think ultimately he was really embraced in the literary community. Although he really, you know, also managed to sort of get in there and duke his way out inside the literary community as well and carve a space for himself. About his sort of Bedouin, identity, I think, you know, he said in the interview with Arab Lit, you know, that he's a writer without a cause, but he said, sometimes though, I feel responsible for the Bedouins, since if I hadn't written about them, including myself, we would have remained in the shadows. So I think he did see himself as sort of representing this community in some way, as well as workers and migrants and all sorts of other people.
Yeah, I was rereading his books yesterday, and he also has funny stories about trying to write about this community and either feeling like he didn't get it right, or he has like a funny aside in one of these books about like writing what he describes as like a very sentimental story about like a heroic uncle of his and then like pissing off his entire family, like everybody being mad at him. I'm not sure why, but it was a complicated endeavor and a responsibility, I think, to tell these stories.
It's interesting because the most recent published novel, My Stone Hands, he says in several interviews that he felt like it was like his greatest achievement and it was a failure. It's this sort of, I don't know, he kind of inhabits this wonderful space with it.
I mean, we should say that he was very funny. He was funny in person, right, and funny on the page. And I think he prized that humor very highly. Like he aimed for it and he appreciated it and he worked at it very hard. Do you remember, I read either Thieves in Retirement or A Dog with No Tail first. I can't remember actually which one. Those are the two other books that are available in English, I think.
Right.
The Men Who Swallowed the Sun. Do you remember like your first impressions of his writing?
Yeah. So that it was gritty and vibrant, and that his sort of description, you know, there's a great sort of colloquialism to it, which I think also, you know, his three translators, Marilyn Booth, Robin Mosher, and Humphrey Davies, I think all worked to bring his orality to the page in English.
He was very lucky with his translators too.
Yeah, extremely lucky. Yeah. And I definitely remember, I think, what was the first one? Maybe A Dog with No Tail was the first work of his that I read. And I just remember being struck by the humanity of it, and the humor of it. It was often funny.
So it's called Lefal in Arabic, which has all these meanings, grammatically the subject, conversationally it means laborer, you know, and it refers to a large extent to the fact that he's telling stories about a time in his youth when he migrated from the village to Cairo and worked on construction crews. And so a lot of the stories have that setting of being on these crews that are doing like really hard manual labor. And at the same time, he's sort of writing and also imagining a life as a writer. He's very funny about his like pretensions as a writer and how self-conscious he feels about them. And at the same time, how clearly seriously he does take them. And about going back to his hometown and lying about what he's doing in Cairo. But also I think there's an element of pride in doing this like very basic physical work. Like it's not a form of selling out and it's not a pretense. And in a way it's sort of like the kind of cleanest work he can do. He sort of splits his time between that and writing, and he was very dedicated to his writing. Like, clearly he really, you know, built his life around that.
And the most important cared thing to him. So deeply about every word. I know he was never satisfied with this title, A Dog with No Tail, that it wasn't as elegant as his original title. Obviously, you could not directly translate it into English, but also he insisted it's a dog with a docked tail. You know, that's the important thing. It's not that there's no tail at all. And the same thing, you know, the rise and the fall of the Saud Sheen, which became The Men Who Swallowed the Sun. But I think he did, because that kind of did capture sort of multiple meanings, that he was ultimately happy with that one. I think he was quite, you know, he cared extremely deeply about, he said, I think that during the process, he spoke at Humphrey's memorial service in February of 2022. And he had a very close relationship with Humphrey, and apparently they spoke, he said that they spoke for an hour a day while it was during lockdown when Humphrey was working on this, about the novel and probably about all sorts of other things as well. Because, you know, there were so many, he said, you know, some Egyptian readers didn't understand it because of the sort of cocktail of dialects. You know, there was Cairene, Fayumi, Bedouin, Libyan, Egyptian, some Italian thrown in there. And that, so they talked extensively about the challenges of rebuilding that in English.
Yeah, I think he really formally pushed the envelope, but did so in a way that was like not arid and not theoretical and not, you know, self-important or like playing games for the sake of playing games. I mean, there's like a lot of, you know, sort of postmodern tools to his tool bag, and like, you know, self-aware narrators and like self-referential, you know, narratives and this kind of, you know, telling you this quality always of like oral storytelling and then like interrupting the story to comment on the story that he's telling and how successful or not he's being at telling it. But then also just this great narrative momentum to a lot of the stories, and also this great spirit of observation. It's very like concentrated, I would say, storytelling, right? Like there's like a mouthful on every page. There's like a lot there. It really, really moves.
Although he did want to, change the form of the novel. And he said, you know, something like, poets write in free verse. Why can't we write free novels too? But the sort of the core of that was not to sort of impress the reader, but to delight and entertain in the same way that, the Bedouin sort of literary mode is, orality, the culture of speech, the culture of storytelling and poetry, but narrative poetry. And I think that he was working that the power of speech into his novels. So when the narrative is recursive, it's recursive in, I think, the same way that you would be speaking and be recursive and turn on something. So I think, you know, his sort of innovations in the novel were also, I don't know, let's say fun innovations.
Yeah, absolutely. It also makes me think of, I mean, I spent more than one afternoon with him in the offices of the publishing house Merit, with Mohammed Hashem and other writers. And there was also that, you know, where, again, that like quintessential, like Cairene, Egyptian, whatever you want to experience of like sitting around with a bunch of smart, funny people who are trying to entertain each other and one up each other in like the jokes and storytelling department. And that infuses his narrative voice too.
Right.
His book, Thieves in Retirement, is also draws on his experiences in the city. It's set in Menshayat Nasser, which is a sort of informal neighborhood, poor neighborhood near Helwan. And it's the story, you know, he has a pretty autobiographical narrator who is an immigrant to the city. And it's all about his, you know, fear and fascination and awe and contempt for this like crazy family that owns the building that he lives in. And his stories about them and about his relationships with them, and also a sort of portrait of the really like, not just, you know, economically insecure, but also like socially contentious sort of environment that you have in a neighborhood of Cairo where a lot of people come from elsewhere. And like relationships have to be negotiated on the fly. And there's a lot of, you know, a fair amount of like criminality and conflict and people just, you know, trying to live their lives or get ahead in one way or another. And again, it's all depicted with a lot of humor. I think I've mentioned this before, but he very kindly, when I was doing a piece about the city of Cairo, took me to this neighborhood for like a visit, you know, and sort of to talk about the Ashwayet, about the informal neighborhoods of Cairo and what they're like. And I remember him saying something like, I don't understand what people mean when they talk about me as like a marginalized writer or this being a marginalized point of view. Like, we're all marginalized in this country. Like, there is no one's at the center. This is the kind, this kind of a neighborhood is Cairo. This kind of a life is Egypt today. Like, you know, and I think he makes, you know, he did, you know, make that point very subtly with his writing of like, you know, bringing those kinds of stories and voices and scenes and putting them at the center of literary work.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he was not pedantic about it at all.
No, and
he was
so
very lighthearted.
Yeah, absolutely. Mohamed Khair, who sort of was the co-winner with Hamdi of the most recent Bonipal Prize for Literary Translation, wrote kind of a sweet little capsule moments of remembering Hamdi at Recife 22, and we'll link to that. And all many of them, you know, show his sort of his the aspect of him as a sort of funny raconteur. I found one of them particularly amusing. That so he won the Naguib Mahfouz Award in 2009, I think, for El Fa'il, which became A Dog with No Tail. And it was reported in the press, I guess, that he won this big $10,000 prize, when in fact it's actually a $10,000 prize, a symbolic monetary award to go with the prestige of the name of Naguib Mahfouz. But, you know, he suggested that, you know, that, you know, the press just couldn't believe it was so small, so they tacked on another zero, and that he you know, laughed and told Mohamed Khair, of course, when I win an important prize, its reward must be, you know, is symbolic, such is my luck. So he's, you know, got these, Mohamed Khair has these sweet little moments remembering him in this piece.
And you've run something on Arab Lit, and I'm sure there are going to be other pieces by other people. Like you mentioned also, I think he had a close relationship with all of his translators. I know that Robin Moger, who's a friend and a former roommate in another life and translated his novel, that they became thick as thieves. I mean, I think he was a really fun person to spend time with and a fun person to talk to and really engaging. And I know that as like a young, you know, journalist and critic, he was very kind and very open, and very curious about my curiosity, you know, in his work and in the literary scene in Cairo. So I think, I mean, he's going to be missed by so many people.
Absolutely. Every writer who I've spoken to, since his passing, who I mentioned him to has said, oh, yes, you know, I knew him for a long time or I just met him a couple years ago. He was so kind to me, everyone said. And Marilyn Booth had just been talking to him about potentially translating My Stone Hands. So I hope somehow that continues to go forward.
I do too. He also wrote a book about Cairo, like the streets and stories of Cairo that I would very much like to read. I hope that all of his work is translated. And luckily, you know, in addition to the recently published book, there are three excellent translations in English of his work. So people who are interested have places to start. And I think, you know, he was really... really a remarkable figure and talent and well worth people's time. And I think with that, maybe we will conclude this introduction and go ahead and run our even longer discussion of his, I think you called it picaresque, Bedouins epic.
Yes.
So we'll conclude there, but there's more to come now.
Hello and welcome to episode 82 of the Bulak podcast. I'm Ursula Lindsay in Amman, and with me, as usual, is my friend and colleague, Marsha Links-Quayle in Rabat.
Hello, Ursula.
Hi. And today we're going to be talking about two books that are both from Egypt and both in some way about migration. Certainly one is very much about the experience of migration and the other one is about that experience among others. So these are the book, The Men Who Swallowed the Sun by Hamdi Abu Ghulayl. This is out from Hoopoe, the imprint of AUC Press, and translated by Humphrey Davies. And the other book that we'll hopefully get to also is Slipping by Mohamed Khair. This is out from Two Lions Press and translated by Robin Moger. But we'll start with The Men Who Swallowed the Sun, which I was interested to read because I'm actually know Hamdi Abu Ghulayl from quite a while back and was an admirer of a book of his that won the Naguib Mahfouz Award from AUC Press, I think already like a decade ago, probably.
Right, which he references in this book, in one of the sort of wonderful oral asides that he makes.
Right. So, that book and this book are sort of have a lot of autobiographical elements to them. So, although I think they are fiction, they are sort of based on the author's experiences. And this earlier book was called in Arabic El Fa'al, and which just means I think the workman, the one who does.
Right.
Because he worked for a long time in construction in Cairo when he first emigrated to Cairo. And so they were short stories kind of about the experiences that he'd had living on the periphery of the city and doing this manual work all around the city. And I was very struck with that collection, I remember. And actually then was very interested at that time in like informal neighborhoods in Cairo.
Mm.
Was doing, eventually I wrote my master's thesis on the portrayal in literature of the modern capital city of Cairo, including the sort of margins and the ashwayet, the informal neighborhoods. So I sort of sought him out and wrote about that and visited one of the neighborhoods that he had featured in that book, which was a completely informal sort of quote unquote slum neighborhood on the outskirts of Cairo.
And interestingly, so that was also published by Hoopoe, which was then AUC Press, and the title was changed. And this book that we're talking about today was called Qiyam wa Inhiyar al-Sajjin, The Rise and Fall of the Sajjin, which I understand why they wouldn't want to have Sajjin al-Sahra al-Sharqiyya, the name of this group that that is sort of followed through the novel as the title. But I really like actually the original title as well. I find it really evocative of the sort of historical nature of the project.
Right. So I sort of said, yes, El Fale was translated as a dog with no tail, T-A-L-E. Mm. And I liked the Arabic title better. And like you said, here again, the title was changed and his original title, the Saad Sheen. So these are two letters of the Arabic alphabet. Is the way he refers throughout to this Bedouin community that lives on the border, across the border between Libya and Egypt, and that he belongs to.
Yes, and I had to do a little bit of reading up about the Saad Sheen because I didn't know this that there was a name, the El Sahara El Shaqiya, the people of the Eastern Desert. And according to, so there's an interesting academic article that we can link to called The Practice and Culture of Smuggling in the Borderland of Egypt and Libya by a man named Thomas Huskin, who says that he sort of did 20-some, a couple dozen interviews with people he says are, you know, some of them see themselves as smugglers and some as traders who don't deal in customs, but in any case live in this transnational community. And so he lived among smugglers and based his article on his academic article and interviews with them. And he says that the Saad Sheen title is a pejorative, and that many of the people who are called Saad Sheen reject it as, he says, dishonorable and discriminatory. So I guess after reading that, I sort of re-saw the novel as sort of reclaiming this Saad Sheen title, you know, in a semi-ironic way, but, you know, in a way of, you know, I think the whole novel is built very much on in the same structure as something like the Epic of Bani Hilal, these old Arabic epics that were told by in coffee houses and elsewhere, that were orally told and retold, and of course also written down in different forms, but that begin, you know, that begin with the story maybe of a great person, and like Zata Hema and others, that begin with the story of a great person, a hero's birth, and then we see, you know, their raids and how, you know, how they struggle, you know, either to sort of unite different tribes or for the supremacy of their tribe. And to me, this is very much a sort of a contemporary remaking of that kind of epic. However, it instead of, you know, you going to raid other people's camels, you are selling drugs and, you know, and smuggling and traveling across borders. You know, there's one point where he says, think of his thefts, and this is the sort of narrator, the Hamdi Abu Ghulail character, talking about the phantom raider, who I think is, you know, sort of the anti-hero or hero of the narrative. Think of his thefts as no more than youthful devilry, a phase usually undergone by those whose forefathers' glorious poetry praised their dashing exploits on horseback, plundering or robbing at knife point. So to me, this is, you know, although it begins instead of with the Phantom Raver, with the story of Gaddafi's birth, actually. But I don't think Gaddafi is actually the hero of this particular epic, although he figures quite a lot.
Right. Well, he's the patron of this particular like movement, right? Because
right.
Hamdi Abu Ghulail explains that Gaddafi gave automatic Libyan citizenship to all the members of a couple, I think, Bedouin tribes that lived there on the border, including the one that he belongs to. And so that meant that a lot of Egyptians migrated to Libya and availed themselves of this automatic right to like go and work and live there. And that's what he narrates, like you said, in this kind of very ironic, modern take on the epic.
Right.
I mean, yeah, where rather than really heroic activities, I mean, it's a story about men testing themselves in one way or another, sort of, but the endeavors that they get into are overwhelmingly criminal and like pretty squalid, kind of funny sometimes. But it is driven actually by, I think that's where you find maybe the little elements of emotional sadness or depth to the story too, is that it is driven by a desire to like prove yourself, give your life some sort of meaning, be someone, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. In the sort of origin stories, I think of both Hamdi Abu Ghulayl, you know, the Abu Ghulayl's, his own origin as migrating to Libya, and as well as the Phantom Raider, who has many names, who Meg writes both to Libya and then later to Italy. Now I lost my train of thought. I'm so sorry.
Well, wait, yeah. So this is a confusing part of the book, though. So the book sort of begins in this kind of burst of narrative energy and momentum, which it actually sustains throughout, right? So it kind of throws out at you like the history of the Bedouin tribes in Egypt, you know, the history of Gaddafi. Like it's sort of setting the stage for eventually it'll get to our narrator and why he went to Libya in the 70s to this like crazy Wild West Libyan town. And then eventually it settles into an alternation between the narrator, which seems to be a double of the author. I mean, he has the author's name and his account of being in Libya. And this story, which is also told in the first person, but it's seemingly a different character. And as you mentioned, the Phantom Raider, and he has many other nicknames and aliases, who crosses the Mediterranean and becomes a drug dealer in Milan, right? So you have those two alternating narrative threads, which at first, I've honestly found hard to tell apart. I thought it was all one character. But I think you're right that it's one character telling his own story and someone else's story.
Right. Yeah. And he does it in very much an oral style, you know, in this kind of as if he's in a coffee shop and telling this to us, the listeners. And I did enjoy how sometimes he would throw in these absolute non sequiturs. Like he says at one point, he suddenly throws in about Ibrahim Akuni, who is a Libyan author who's lived in Switzerland for, I don't know, 30 years now or something, but who continues to write about Libya and the Tuareg people living in the desert. And he even says something like, I'm not even going to apologize for saying here for no particular reason that Ibrahim Akuni is lost. You know, he's writing about imaginary Libyans and imaginary camels. It's just, you feel, I felt at some points that Hamdi was there speaking this story to me. And I found that those little authorly asides wonderful and funny.
Yeah, it definitely has the quality I think we both enjoy, which is like a very strong voice.
Mm.
Just to give a short sense of what this voice is, like, for example, so he goes and he picks this town, Sabha, which I'd never heard of, but apparently it's ruled mostly by Gaddafi's family at that time. And this is how he describes it, partly. He says, Sabha pullulated with the vermin of nations, pullulated with the vermin of Africa, Arab Africa and African Africa and mixed up Africa. The people from the bottom of the heap were there, right there at the bottom of the heap. Even the rulers were from the bottom of the heap. relations of the leader and commander, but not part of the stable elite that surrounded him in Sirte. Most of them little no-account Bedouin from Egypt, Tunisia, Chad, and Niger, and making themselves out to be Libyan. The quintessence of the people the leader himself manufactured, for himself and as his personal property. And then he says, applying my philosophy of always taking the seat at the back of the class, I crossed the whole of Libya and came to a stop in Sabha. Then I left the rest of Sabha behind and settled down among its most dangerous criminals. And, you know, he just, then he goes on to like describe, you know, this he's bootlegging, he's living in a brothel. He's supposedly this kind of like innocent in the midst of all these like hardened criminals. And you get the tone, like it's the opposite of romantic and heroic.
Right. Yeah. He calls himself a naive soul in a pack of rogues, although he doesn't seem naive at any point, but he does a fantastic job of mocking himself, of saying, you know, he never realized that the shaft was going into him until it was all the way in.
Right. And no, I mean, he is really the story of a survivor, like an all out survivor who always like manages. But also, I suppose it's a story, I mean, by his own definition of a fuck up, like he also never kind of, both of the stories, right? I mean, they leave home to become millionaires, to achieve this kind of dreamt of success, to come home like as the big shot.
To live in a villa. Yeah. Huge imagination of what it's going to be like. And even though, yeah, the Phantom Raider, he gets to Italy and he does like make huge amounts of money. He also loses huge amounts of money very shortly afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, the stories of the drug trade that is engaged. So it's all, you know, migrants from all over North Africa and Eastern Europe in Milan running these various drug operations and in and out of prison. And I mean, there's a level of violence throughout that is really shocking. I mean, and fascinating, of course, it creates a lot of the drama of the story. But from the beginning in the Libyan town, there's just so much male posturing and kind of endless, pointless, you know, threatening and beating and extortion, and like as if they can't think of anything else to do or any other way to prove themselves, you know? And just, I mean, between the two narrators, they must have like 50 near-death experiences throughout the book.
right. But I think, you know, in part, that's the epic of your, you know, you're proving yourself with your dashing exploits on horseback or camelback. But one of the things that you mentioned, that there are all these, you know, there's the Armenians and there's the Romanians, and there are all these groups, particularly in Italy, who are part of this underclass or this non-legal.
They're all there illegally, and they're all engaging in illegal activity, and they're all kind
right.
Of,
but you so know. if I imagine this, the rise and fall of the Sadjin, as a kind of a history, it's like this wonderful. It's not an Egyptian history, you know. It's not like a national history. It's all a history of all these. That sort of belies sovereignty, territorial, citizenship. A portrait of sort of a transnational history that works against borders and boundaries and official papers and laws, and certainly against laws all the time.
Yeah. No, it's very cosmopolitan. I mean, cosmopolitanism doesn't have to be an upper class thing. It's an extremely international, like mixed book. The other thing that I think is sort of, you know, rings true. Of course, you read a book like this, you have you have no familiarity. I mean, I don't, with this kind of experience. All you can experience is whether it feels true or not. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it does. It has this voice and it really like has this texture kind of, right, of someone's experience, of course, like filtered through a sensibility. But the other thing is there's all, he talks a lot about all these different communities and he interacts with and goes into business and has relationships with people, you know, from different countries, but he also engages in like a lot of kind of like classification, you know, of the different right. groups.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Like, you know, don't mess with the, I don't know, Algerians. Like they're the really tough ones that won't let you mug them. And like, you know, I mean, it's a lot of classification in who's toughest.
Right.
But again, that feels like the way that men in this world having these experiences would sort of classify each other. Right. So they're sort of crossing those lines all the time, but they're also like redrawing those lines all the time.
But redrawing them not in the way that they're drawn by states, I think, but redrawing them in sort of, yeah, these local communities that may be held together by ethnicity or religion or whatever they're held together by. But yes, by relationships, usually, in this kind of like epic sense of, you know, who's related to who.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of negotiating. I mean, there's acts of kindness and acts of loyalty and then like recurrent acts of betrayal. I mean, there's sort of both of all of that, right?
Right.
And it is overwhelmingly a male universe. I mean, women mm-hmm. feature very scantily.
Often in the act of being taken advantage of. Although not always. There's a Ghanaian woman who shows up and I think it's the Hamdi Abu Ghulail, the primary narrator asks her, what's she doing here? He looks at her as a fallen woman. You know, this is, he's got some sort of, you know, right. thing that he mocks of, you know, morale, you know, old fashioned morality that he's brought with him. And she says, you know, I'm here to work just like you, you know, she manages in a sort of a perfect, or an imperfect rather Arabic, in a very scornful way. So although women appear rarely and often just as, you know, saggy breasts being squeezed.
Well, often they do sex workers,
right?
I mean, yes, that's usually that's the predominant workers. Experience that they have of them, and then there's some girlfriends in Italy, basically.
Right. Although, yeah, the girlfriends also tend to sort of run in the same circle of, you know, drug dealing and, if not sex work, sort of demi sex work or peri sex work or whatever you would call it.
I mean, it's not something I automatically criticize, this dearth of, I think it's in the story that he's telling. I think he's trying to be, he's trying to represent and be true to like a certain experience. And in that experience, I think that's how women are. He's not, women are important in the sense that they're a motivating pleasure in life, it seems right. like to the narrator, right. but there's not a lot of time spent really on thinking about them or describing their character, their feelings. There's much more about the relationships with the other men that you're in business with and doing things with and hanging out with than there is. There's no female character with any interiority, really. But what I'm saying is I think that's might be a conscious choice. Like he's presenting a certain universe and it's
absolutely,
an overwhelmingly macho male one.
Right. Right. And the sex work is not just the sex work of women. There's also sex work available to men, but it's portrayed through, I think, this Phantom Raider character in this extremely macho way, like you know, like you can be a sex worker as a man, but you know, there's like some humiliation to being on the bottom of if you're a sex worker working, you know, men with men. Although he, you know, the Phantom Raider at one point sort of, you know, pulls back his shoulders and say, you know, I don't care what you do with your own body, you know, as if he's right. Suddenly progressive.
Right. Well, the morality of this world is sort of not obvious.
Right.
There are codes of conduct, but because the narrator himself is so kind of like sardonic and like self-deprecating and sort of it's hard, you know, he's not giving you like an earnest account of his, you know, values or principles or whatever. You know what I mean? Like you have to kind of experience the whole thing to see. He's not talking to you about his feelings particularly. I mean, there's very few moments in which you get even male interiority, right? Like it's not
a novel about interiority. I think in the same way that an epic is not about interiority, it's about the movement and about the battle and about proving yourself and finding it's action. But it's also so much humor.
But that's the thing is I would use the word picaresque about this book more than like epic. I mean, I don't think it has the tone of an epic at all, right? Like, I don't think it has. I think it's kind of an anti-epic. Like, it's purposely. I mean, it's maybe
right, but I think
it
draws. Right, I think it draws from the local tradition of the epic. But yes, in a sort of a picaresque mode, in this sort of ironic tone that it's told in. And it made me think about this book that I'd also really liked, called African Titanics, by an Eritrean novelist, Aboubakar Khel. That came out maybe in Arabic in 2008, and I don't remember when it came out in English in Charles Bredon's translation. But it follows a man named Abdar, who's an Eritrean, and he first goes to Sudan and then crosses the Libyan desert. And this book is also, I highly recommend it, but it's very different. It's very like personal and individual. It is about the portraits of these people that he meets along this pathway. And it all is also, you know, sort of not autobiographical. The author himself lived for 20 years in Tripoli, and he had to leave only in 2011. He's, you know, one of the, you know, many Africans who came from across the continent and ended up in Libya. And, you know, initially imagining that they would travel across to Europe, but then stayed. In February of 2011, I think he ended up first in a refugee camp and then in Denmark. But that novel is so much about the sort of beautiful portraits of people in these terrible circumstances. So I was imagining it as, so the portrait that he paints of being on this a zodiac and crossing the Mediterranean is also just as harrowing, but it's like funny and a bit slapstick. And, you know, they think they see Lampedusa, but actually, no, it's just a big ship. They throw everything overboard so they won't be caught. And then, nope, it was just a ship.
They get drunk. They go swimming.
Right.
And then when the coastal guard comes to get them, they're like argue with them because they don't believe them that they're Italians and they like only want to be taken. But that was the scene where I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Like your boat is sinking and they're like, we won't come on board unless you guarantee that you're taking us to Italy. And it's all like,
they're like no Malta, no Malta.
Right. I mean, respect, man.
Right. And so it is absolutely never this sort of maudlin tale about the emigrant. Not that African Titanics is. African Titanics is extremely moving and specific and individual and psychological. This is ridiculous. And the migrant is never sort of this noble person who's coming because they're leaving their home, you know. But of course they're people all the same who have the same right to go do crimes in other countries. Come on.
Well, I mean, but I think that's what's That's what's interesting. I mean, one of the many things that's interesting about The Man Who Sold His Son is that he takes the risk of making his main characters unsympathetic, and of, mm-hmm. and he's not, he doesn't hesitate to show them basically engaging in like antisocial and criminal behavior, which, you know, you might hesitate to sort of write a book that portrays refugees and migrants that way because of like other considerations. But we've talked about how tiresome it is for even writers, you know, Syrian writers or others from countries where so many people have emigrated, to feel boxed into only portraying that experience in one particular sympathetic way. And Hamdi Abu-Ghalayl certainly doesn't particularly. At the same time, that through the sheer, like, just the voice of the story, you have sympathy for the narrator. I mean, you care about what's going to happen to them. You're interested in what's going to happen to them, right?
Right.
There was a passage that you were going to read that sort of is one of the few where one of the narrators kind of expresses some of maybe what he's feeling all along under this like churning action about, you know, being abroad, being alone, you know, sort of trying to figure it out every day from scratch.
Right. And this is the Phantom Raider. Another time I got to know another guy. His name was Ashraf Unasa from Tatuntu. He was a cocaine addict and snorted it a lot. Even though it was me who'd brought the bunch to the house, I was scared of them. I'd get up early. It didn't matter how late I'd stayed up. I'd get up early because I just had one wish during my life there. What with the squats, the fear, and the drugs, I hoped and I prayed and I begged the Lord, before I die, please let me sleep one night without fear. I'd get high on a couple of joints and I'd sit down on my own and cry over how my life was. It has to be this way. It's no use trying to live any other way. This is the only way I know how to live. I'd have died if I'd have come to this country to be a respectable type and lived off the churches and hadn't done anything wrong. I'd have died. I know lots of Egyptians who haven't done a thing wrong from the moment they arrived. The moment they wake in the morning, they have breakfast at the church and they have lunch at the church and they get their clothes from the church. A life not fit for a dog. I can't live like that. Muhibu Musa, who was a daredevil in Egypt and managed to get by even if he had to steal, wasn't the type to live like that. So I got into drugs and went for it. I'd sit on my own and smoke a couple of joints and look at the sky and cry. I cried because I was scared my goods would get stolen. I was scared the police would pop up out of nowhere and find goods on me and I'd go to prison. I was scared some Moroccans or Tunisians would attack me with cleavers and knives and take everything I had, 20 or 30 or to go. What are you going to do against them? Right behind where you're staying, there's a waste ground where there's everybody, Moroccans, Africans, Albanians, Romanians, God knows who else. And from the day we threw the Romanians out of the place we're living in, other people had their eye on it. A whole villa and great looking. We were scared. We didn't go in by the station. So scared we didn't go in by the station door. Instead, we'd opened the outside door, the one that gave out straight to the street. I'd smoke a couple of joints and sit alone and feel like, I don't know, like you want to go home, but you can't. You haven't made any money. Everything you get is spent on drugs and you haven't sent anything back to your family, so you can't go back there, so that you can go back there. Go back to what? And anyway, time's up. You're older now. What are you going to do there? So you go on living in this wasteland, always on edge, on edge, on edge about everything, a strange land and no one to get your back. Yeah, there's a point at which he says, yeah, the one of the terrible things is getting killed there and nobody to take revenge for you.
which is specific, which is, yeah, that is one of the very few points in the book where that narrator kind of, you know, lets down his guard or doesn't just keep, you know, talking about events and, you know, stratagems and ups and downs. And maybe because of that, I found that very, very moving, that point of admission of vulnerability.
Right. And even, you know, not to spoil it, but he does, I think they tell us quite early on, but he does go back. they both end up back in Egypt. But, you know, it's very much this sort of whole narrative of the rise and fall of the Sadrin, who also rise and fall because the leader himself, Hedefi, rose and fell.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, parts of it, there's not much rise. Like, it just goes to, I mean, it's not like they build an empire and then it collapses. No. You know, one of them, you know, the story where he goes to Libya, he opens a workshop that produces very bad quality cement blocks and makes his real money off of making moonshine.
Right. But that's kind of what I love about it. You know, the rise and fall of the Sadrin, like the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. But yes, it's a pretty shitty empire.
Anyway, I liked this book a lot. I thought it was I mean, as much as, you know, like a lot of writing that we're seeing these days, like it does not have a very structured plot. Mm-hmm. It's basically all carried on this, like, you know, voice that approximates, you know, the storytelling orality, and it has this kind of abrupt. And, you know, the plot doesn't get massaged much into place. Like there's not a lot of structure. There's just this kind of flow. But
right. I imagine it like, you know, hitting record on the storyteller in the coffee shop and then just hitting stop at the end. And that's the novel.
Right.
He even starts it by referring to Osama Dinosaurus, my beloved dog, my old dog. Without really, there's no explanation about who this Osama is. He's a, you know, I guess the two of them were friends. I imagine, you know, they must have run in the same circles. I didn't know Hamdi, but without, you know, without sort of, it doesn't, make a lot of effort to make a tight plot to re-edit the book afterwards. I just imagine it as a verbal performance.
And some of them that's not to say that that's not a purposeful choice, because right. I think, you know, like this is a different, considerably different style than his previous book, which is these quite concentrated short stories that each of one is a sort of contained vignette, at least. Like, again, there's not a strong overall narrative arc, but it's a quite different style. So I think this is a choice. But I found it quite, it like really immerses you in these worlds, which are sort of fascinating and, like I said, like super disturbing to me. I mean, but that's what makes them fascinating. That they're slightly terrifying, and it has humor, I think it's
I just think of it. So he dedicates it to Suleiman al-Fahd, who he says is the great Kuwaiti writer and historian, and I guess maybe that is part of what. Although he does, you know, sort of very self-consciously begin it with a lot of. History of these Bedouin communities in Egypt from the time of the Romans on through the contemporary era, that I imagine it as this kind of transgressive history of people living between borders and unsettled and moving constantly looking for something.
Yeah, I like that transgressive history because you do feel like you're getting... You know, you're getting a history, a part of the history of that region, of those communities that maybe isn't recorded anywhere but in literature and art. And he mentions music and poetry, and it's a kind of fascinating record too of like a particular time and atmosphere.
Right. And not necessarily all high poetry and high music either. You know, there's sort of poetic and musical riffs made off the Green Book in order to appeal to Hedefi, but it's this, I found it to be this great sort of cultural history of a moment, even though it is also fictional.
Mm. Yeah. Well, should we talk a little bit about the other book that we also read this past weekend?
Yes, yes.
We should say that. So this past weekend, you finished an issue of ALQ. I don't know how many all-nighters you just pulled to get that together.
Right. Me and poor Hassan going through the pages and the page proofs.
And this is your issue on the theme is mirrors, right?
Yes, it is the 13th issue.
Cool.
Which lucky 13, I like to think. And
oh,
it is.
I'm a huge believer in lucky 13.
Excellent. Mm. And yes, the theme is mirrors, from starting with how Al-Jahez has described mirrors and sort of his philosophy of mirrors, through Andalusian mirrors and contemporary. And I guess one of the things that struck me again and again was the different ways in which male writers and women writers in all the submissions, not just in what we included, portrayed mirrors. Men as associating mirrors more with memory and nostalgia and looking back, and women much more with feeling sort of the mirror constantly around them and distorting their image, and the mirror sort of, you know, constantly telling them who they need to be now, presenting a sort of an idealized version.
And this issue will be out when?
Before this episode airs.
Okay. So by the time you hear about this, the issue
right.
will be available. Okay.
Right. Yes.
And you should say where exactly.
Right. You can always buy it at arablit.gumroad.com, or you can just go to Arablit website and find it there.
But you don't seem loopy at all for someone who I know has gotten very little sleep and spent hours and hours and hours looking at text and images for the last couple of days. And then on top of that, we had a slight rescheduling thing. And so we actually read this book, both of us, I think, like very, very quickly in the last couple of days. So I think we're coming off of it quite fresh, right?
Yes. Yeah. I actually needed to read this book, The Rise and Fall of Sajjin, a second time to feel certain which parts were in the voices of the narrator and which parts were the voices in the Phantom Raider. And then I had to do some extra research about this, who the Sajjin were, and about these communities in Egypt that are supposedly of Libyan origin, or really are, you know, came from the Maghreb at some point.
Go ahead.
Interestingly, I saw a clip from Leila Al-Amr's presentation, I think at Lancaster Lit Fest, in which she says, she explains why she never glosses the Arabic. She writes in English, but she explains why she never glosses the Arabic for English language readers. She says, we always talk about literature as, you know, bringing the Arab world to the English language reader. And, you know, she said, why doesn't the English language reader also need to come to us in some instances, you know, at least somewhat part of the way. I do feel that in this particular novel, you do need to come to the novel in some cases.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I read for a couple pages of Sajjin's before, and I know the Arabic alphabet before it clicked. You know how that happens? Like when you see a word, an Arabic word in English, and I was just keeping like, okay, the Sajjins, all right, like this, you know, and then finally, okay.
I knew it was Sajjin, but it was a long time before I realized that meant a Sahra al-Sharqiya, you know, because he says, saw the Sajjin, the people of the Eastern Desert. And I didn't put 2 + 2 together and get 4, sadly.
I know, me neither, not right away. So what Laila Al-Amr was talking about is that you wouldn't put a footnote or in parentheses or try and translate that somehow into English, that when she's saying don't gloss it into English, that you leave it as right. is. And also in the book, I enjoyed very much once the part that's set in Italy, there's Italian words that have been Arabized and are then rendered in English.
Yeah.
At one point he's talking about balats this. And again, it takes a while. And then you're like, palazzo. It's building in Italian, but then made with a B because of Arabic and then come into English. I mean, I find these things delightful, actually. And I think it's fine if there's no footnote, because if you don't get it, if you don't know exactly where that word's, you understand from the context that it's the name of a place.
Right.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. Right. And as Layla, I think, said, if you have to Google it, that won't kill you either.
Yeah, no, of course. Of course. I mean, I think you can also go too far the other way, where you purposely put words. If you're writing in English, a story that's set abroad, and you're sort of like purposely inserting kind of foreign words to give a texture of foreignness to the story, where you're like, well, wait a moment, like it's written in English. Why are you interspersing kind of foreign words in here? It's just to make it sound a little foreign. That can happen too. So
right,
it has
absolutely.
To be intentional.
Right. Yeah, I just was thinking that this was a text that you do need to like make a little bit of effort to insert yourself into and figure out what's going on. But I think that there are rewards to it. And actually, I really enjoyed reading Thomas Huskin's The Practice and Culture of Smuggling in the Borderland of Egypt and Libya to kind of understand the history of the Saad Sheen, which he transliterates literally as S-A-D, Saad Sheen.
The so. Saad Shins. It's like the worst gang name ever. we'll link to that anthropology paper. I'm going to talk a little bit about slipping because that's the other book that I read this weekend and had been meaning to read for a very long time. So these are both, I think, on our list. And I think you got to Slipping quite a while ago. And I finally got the impetus to read it. It's been like very, I thought, well received. This is Mohamed Khair's novel and translated by Robin Moger. And I'll try and give a quick synopsis kind of the content of the book, which is difficult because the book has a very kind of evanescent plot. Mm-hmm. So it's the narrator is a young Egyptian man who lives in maybe Alexandria rather than Cairo, I think, and works at a magazine and is sort of given this assignment that involves going to various kind of strange locations with this other older man called Bahar, who has come back to Egypt and is doing some sort of project at these sites. And so the young magazine writer is accompanying him. And that just allows them to kind of keep visiting these slightly strange and surreal places, which include like a spot in the Nile where the tide of the river gets so low that it looks like people are walking on water because there's only like a few inches of water, or a building that's like shaking day and night with the sound of this huge nearby construction, or this village that's empty because the entire village got up and emigrated all together one night. And these stories, and then there's other stories. So it keeps sort of jumping from story to story. And then eventually the stories have like little points of connection. But they're not, you know, there's not, it's very sort of lots of little diversions. And, I wouldn't say that there's like a clear narrative arc. There's also a love story. There's a woman that he keeps describing, a woman that he's loved and seemingly lost, and perhaps by the end of the book recovered. So it's really a book that's a lot about the creation of a particular atmosphere.
Right. And a lot about its musical and sonic landscapes as well, I think.
Yeah. The description, for example, of living in this building that like vibrates constantly to the sound of a huge construction site next door is like, for example, very, very well done. There are these beautiful kind of descriptions, these sort of surreal places and scenes that stay with you. It's a completely different kind of book, though, stylistically, in terms of the voice. You know, it's very melancholy. It's a bit intellectual. It kind of wanders around in circles instead of having this like huge forward thrust, of the Goliath book. I mean, they're really like, you would normally not compare them, I don't think. It's just that since I just read them both, then you can't help it. Like they're in your mind at the same time. And so you think of them. But the one point they have in common actually is that Slipping also deals to a considerable degree with the experience of emigrating, because there's both this scene of this village that decides that if they're going to emigrate, they're all going to emigrate together, and they get like a collective bargain price from the smuggler, and they all go to the ocean one night after surreptitiously kind of selling everything, and they disappear and you never find out if they made it or not. That's kind of left hanging. Mm-hmm. And then the character, this older man called Bahar, as he tells his story to the younger narrator, it turns out that he's someone who emigrated as a young man and spent most of his life abroad and has just come back. There's a passage I could read where he sort of like talks about this experience. It sort of seems like the catalyzing thing that made him decide to emigrate was being arrested at a political protest when he was young. And so there's this passage where he describes his parents coming to pick him up at the jail, and then how at the same time it was being in jail that had made him decide to like always stay on the move and to leave the country, but also to like never settle anywhere. So maybe I'll read this.
Yeah, please do.
Then I saw my parents. My father was talking to a conscript by the gate, wearing an expression I'd never seen on him or anyone else before, an extraordinary blend of weariness, rage, worry, and humiliation. And I wished I could shrink where I sat, grow smaller and smaller until I disappeared into one of the tiny holes the ants had opened in the walls. Then all of a sudden, there was my mother, kissing the conscript's hand. Their voices didn't reach me where I sat. I watched the scene play out silently. My mother's body, rarely seen outside our house, stooped in the reeking yard to kiss the hand of a young conscript who could do nothing in any case, not for her and not for me. My mother abasing herself without realizing that she had no hope of getting anything in return. I watched my father step back and stare at her. His back was turned to me, but I could picture the shock on his face. It was in that moment that I understood, Saif. If you rebel against fate, if you insist on being master of what you call your destiny, the insolence, then life itself might come out and force your mother to her knees. That day, life chose to let me go, though my release had nothing to do with my mother's kiss. They left us in the yard past noon, then undid our cuffs and made us sign papers, and we were allowed to leave. As I signed my name to testimony I had never spoken, the officer said with a smile that we'd meet again soon. Since that day, I've made a habit of keeping that little bag packed. When I still lived at home, I kept it under the bed, a secret from my mother. I stood by the front door after I moved. Sorry, it stood by the front door after I moved. You would know my home, or to be precise, the place where I was staying, by a small bag packed and ready by the door.
Right. Yeah, that's a very sort of also lovely peripatetic, but a very different sort of peripatetic than in Hamdi Abu Ghalayl's novel.
And it ascribes, I would say, more explicitly in a way, a motivation to the decision to leave home, to not settle down, to emigrate, right? I mean, it draws this pretty explicit line between not being master of your fate and facing these injustice, you know, it's unjust. He's arrested for protesting. He's
right.
He's humiliated for no reason. And this decision to leave. Where none of that is
much more reflective. Yeah, no, it reminds me much
more explicitly political a bit, right. You know.
Right. Reminds me much more of Amr Azzet or Haizam al-Wardani, a very different sort of, both of these feel like very Egyptian books to me, but in sort of different threads of Egyptian literature. Hamdi much more like Khairi Chalabi or, you know, lots of the like sort of outrageous drug stories.
Right. Or something like, I don't know, maybe even a bit, not the drug story, but the sort of like collective voice, the neighborhood thing. I was thinking about like Ibrahim Aslan's Malik al-Hazin, Kit Kat, you know, also this great tradition of like humor and making light of very serious things. I think even also that book, Women of Karantina, you know, which is a
kind of crime story. El Touchi's novel, yes.
Yeah. Whereas, like you said, slipping is in another kind of genre that's very strong right now, which is more of a kind of there's a sort of like it's on the edge between personal essay and fiction and almost like philosophizing. You know, it's almost metaphysical in its concerns, like what's real and what's not, and what do we experience and what do we not. And you know, and the tone is more about, I mean, I think that the two tones are always there in Egyptian literature and Egyptian life, right? Like
right.
I mean, in every, you know, humor is so often another way of dealing with loss, with difficulty, you know.
Right.
And so they're not maybe as far apart as they seem, but certainly the effect and the mood is very different.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, even where, the movement is similar, or the issues are similar. Yeah. The mood is very different, but they both feel, exceptionally Egyptian to me, just in different ways.
Yeah. Slipping has almost this quality of like, you're not sure if it's a dream or it's real. Like it's very untethered from, the narrator could have dreamt the whole thing up, and that kind of comes up multiple times in the story. There are these elements, you know, the woman he loves sort of can reproduce any sound. You know, there's these really magical elements to the story, kind of. Although then he slips in, well, she does sound effects for animated movies. So then you're sort of like, oh, we haven't completely moved out of the realm of real. And he actually does that really cleverly multiple times, where there's a scene, for example, you know, they see someone walk across a river.
Right.
You think, oh, I'm in the realm of the miraculous, the completely magical realism. And then he tells you, what's because the tide is low at this one time of the year. And so people take this as a shortcut, and it looks like they're walking across water, and it's just like 5 inches of water.
Right.
And so he recreates the effect you would have of thinking something was unbelievable and you had no explanation for it, and then finding it. And that's done very well, as is the kind of like tenuous connections that he keeps making between the different stories. I think it's quite hard to sort of plot a book like this that seems plotless or almost plotless, but isn't. I mean, there is a pattern. There is a narrative pattern, right? It's just that you can't, it takes a while to identify it. You know, they're both sort of narratives that resist a little bit being summed up. You know what I mean? Or being...
I think they, neither one of them gives you an answer. Are we supposed to be pleased at the end of the novel? Are we supposed to be sad for him? He doesn't tell us how we're supposed to feel about it. I don't think it's positioned in such a way that we're made to look in a particular direction. We can decide for ourselves what we think about what the story means.
Yeah. Well, and people should. You should check out both of these books. They're really quite worthwhile. And I think with that, we're going to close out for this week.
Yes. Thank you so much for talking with me about these books.
Well, pleasure as always. And also don't forget to check out the new issue of Arab Lit Quarterly. Okay. Bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.